Musical Talk, the UK independent musical theatre podcast.
You are currently hearing the overture to Peter Pan, the British musical. I'm Nick Hudson, welcome to this week's episode of Musical Talk. I had the pleasure of sitting down with Pierce Chater Robinson, who wrote this musical of Peter Pan that I saw many, many years ago, and as you'll hear in the interview, is responsible for me gaining a love of musical theatre. It was an absolute joy to sit down with Pierce, and I hope you enjoy listening to this episode as well. Pierce Chater Robinson. Hello, Pierce.
Hello.
How are
morning.
You? Very well, Nick. Nice
good.
To, nice to be here.
You are the composer, lyricist, and book writer and director of a musical version of Peter Pan that I saw when I was, as I said, 10 years old in 1994
at
the Cambridge Theatre, which is now home to a sort of
Matilda.
Yeah, another family musical. I want to get you in to talk about this show and your other shows, but mostly this one, because Peter Pan, for me, was probably the first great musical I remember seeing. I was having dinner with a friend the other night, and we just suddenly bonded over this musical because she did it as an Amdram piece. I saw the West End production with Ron Moody.
Ron Moody, yes.
A very timely discussion, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Tell us first about your history with the piece.
I was a very young schoolmaster, schoolteacher down in East Sussex. Part of my job, that I was newly qualified, and part of my job was to teach English and all the drama and help out with a little bit of music on the side.
Were you trained in music?
No, I did my training in English, actually, yeah, English teaching. But I taught in those days, I don't do it now, but in those days I used to blow a trumpet quite regularly, even though my first instrument is the keyboard. So I used to take quite a fair amount of children for their trumpet lessons as well. But as such, I was part of the production of Joseph and his amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, and then, of course, Oliver and all the other standards. I think we did The Sound of Music, and we sort of ran out of things to do. So one crazy afternoon, I said to the headmaster, why don't I write you something? And he said, do you know how to do that? And I said, no, I've got absolutely no idea at all. So the first show I ever wrote, which will remain firmly on the bookshelves, was a treatment of Rudyard Kipling's Storky & Co., which was a great success because it was about a school, Westward Ho School in Devon. And all the kids in the school played the kids, and all the staff in the school played the staff. And it was a huge joint effort. And the following year, the headmaster said, would you like to have another go at something? And I did. That worked. And the following year, I'd sort of run out of ideas, really. I was reading Peter Pan to one of my English classes. And I just happened to look in the front of the book and saw that the copyright belonged to Great Ormond Street Hospital for Sick Children. And so I wrote to them and said, would you mind, I said, I'm a nobody from East Sussex. I'm a school teacher and we're going to do four performances. I would love to write an adaptation of your Peter Pan. And within a week, I got a very strict letter back saying, you'll do nothing of the sort. This is a very, very closely guarded subject. So being young and determined, in those days, we had cassettes. Do you remember those?
Yeah.
Cassettes. Whatever happened to the cassette? So I sent this cassette off with me strumming on the piano about six of the numbers, most of which still remain in the score today. And I heard nothing because I thought, well, that's the end of that. And I said to the headmaster,
you also wonder they must get loads of,
yes, of
people
course,
saying,
absolutely,
want to do this and do that.
About 6 months later, out of the blue, comes this letter from the trustees, the special trustees of Great Ormond Street, saying, we're very sorry, Mr. Robinson, that we took so long in responding to your second letter. But actually, your cassette went round the families of the trustees, and we rather like it. And we'd like you to go ahead with your school production in East Sussex. and we're going to come and see it. So I thought, right, off we go. So I did the adaptation that summer holidays, I seem to remember. And most of the music, some of the later music was written later, but most of the original music was composed then and there. So this must be 76 or 77, 78, sometime, that sort of time.
Because we're talking about before we started, what your musical... were you a musical theatre fan, or were you... Could you say you play the piano, but how did you learn to compose and all this kind of...
I don't know. I didn't have a training, and now I can see from Goldsmiths College, you can get trained in musical theatre composition and all of that.
Which I did.
Which you did, I know. I was reading your biography, and I thought, oh my goodness, I'm going to be talking to somebody who knows what he's...
You can interview me next.
Somebody who knows what he's talking about. So it's going to be very worrying. Anyway, they came to see the show, the first Peter Pan, and I got a letter again from the hospital a few weeks later. I went out to dinner following the performance with the head of the trustees, and I got another letter saying, put your show on again in another school, persuade the headmaster to spend as much money as... and we're going to bring everyone down to see it. Cut a long story short, I did it again in another school. And this time we had a professional band. After that, I was told that it was going to be published by Samuel French. By now, it's 1984-85. I was told that originally it would be a version for schools, but come 89, it would be called Peter Pan the British Musical. And because there was only other... there was one other version, which was the American version, which was launched in 1954.
Mary Martin.
With Mary Martin.
There's also the Disney version as well.
Yes.
So there's two sort of...
Well, you mean the cartoon?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely, yes. And they were in the both in the 50s. So mine was a much more sort of up-tempo, if you like, version. And it was written on this side of the pond, which I think Great Ormond Street rather liked, that there was a British musical version.
I was talking about it on the podcast years ago, and the one sort of... issue my co-presenter had with it is it does the music is very American.
Yes.
So do you think the British musical do you think lends to the title, or cause well, it's not the British musical anymore, is it?
Well, it is on it's called Peter Pan the Musical, but I think the American version is also called Peter Pan the Musical. I think it was originally called Peter Pan the British Musical simply to identify it against the American version. And French has published it, and it actually started to become very regularly performed by the market it was written for originally, which was schools. And when it came to the West End version, it was time to actually sit down and rethink the book.
This is the dream, in a way, that you write a show for schools, it gets performed, and then...
Well, it's the Joseph story,
isn't it? Then someone picks it up, and then... it gets performed everywhere, and then you go to the West End.
Yes, we did before it went into the West End, simply because it was becoming a very popular show that Samuel French were licensing, and we were doing no publicity on it at all. It was just word of mouth, word of mouth, word of mouth everywhere, and a lot of schools were doing it, but a lot of Amdram societies started doing it as well. And then because Samuel French have agents in different countries, they have what used to be a company called Domini in Australia, and now Origin in Australia is their agent. And Origin are huge. They look after all Andrew Lloyd Webber's staff. And once Pan was on their books as well, a lot of Australian community theatres started to do it, because by then people could hear the music. We'd made rudimentary recordings of it. This was long before the EMI recording, which was made in 1995. And I think that you're right. There was a slow progression of interest in the piece, but in a sort of wonderfully international way. Mm. I mean, we're in nine languages now, I find that quite extraordinary. And I've directed it in
nine languages?
No, I've directed it in Danish.
Translators and everything.
Well, I worked with a wonderful team in Denmark when we performed it in 98, 99, and then again in 2001, 2002, because we smashed their box office record, which was lovely. So they wanted it back within 3 years, which was nice. And it really sounds, to an English ear, it sounds quite strange in Danish. And in Dutch, it sounds, you know, again, quite odd. But obviously not to the audiences that are enjoying it.
From a composer's point of view, does changing into different languages affect the stresses and the musical phrases you've written? I know nothing about foreign languages, but I'm always interested how rhymes are met in translations. When you've sat for ages working on a clever rhyme, and then to have it not work in another language.
Yes, it's interesting. Some of the words that have a wonderful ring in English, like Tinkerbell, which of course is a J.M. Barrie invention.
Barryism,
yeah. Tinkerbell is to a Danish ear, because Tinkerbell becomes Klokkeblomst. Well, can you imagine a fairy called Klokkeblomst? It's quite odd directing in Denmark. And Neverland.
The characters are so famous. Do you have to change the names?
In Denmark, we had Kapitän Klo instead of Captain Hook. Neverland became Ønske Øen, which is interesting. Don't ask me what all of these were in Dutch, because I can't remember. But no, you're right. The energy behind directing this piece is very similar. It doesn't matter which country you're in. And I direct it with Mr. Darling being the buffoon and Captain Hook being very dark. I don't like Captain Hook being the same as Mr. Darling, but in a pirate costume.
Which is why Peter Pan never works as a pantomime.
I think it's a very troubling pantomime.
Barry's script, because it's not very funny.
No, it's. I think I'm very troubled by seeing pantomime versions of it. There are pantomimical qualities in Peter Pan. What we call the fourth wall comes down. Unashamedly, because of course when Tinkerbell is dying in Act 2, I wrote a song called You've Got to Believe in Fairies, which is just about the most simplistic, on purpose, the most simplistic rock number I think I used.
It's the sing-along, isn't it?
It's the sing-along, it's got three chords, or at the most four, and the whole idea is that the audience, when they've heard the first chorus, know how to sing the second chorus,
it's a small world.
And they join in, and the kids in the audience get put on the shoulders of their fathers, and we light the auditorium with lasers and mirror balls and goodness knows what, and it is the big moment, and that moment works
everywhere.
It doesn't matter which country you're in. Yeah,
you get to the West End.
Yes.
Amazingly, which is brilliant.
Then we went on tour.
Yes. I saw the West End productions. This is where I come into the story.
Yes.
And I loved it. We mentioned Ron Moody playing...
Ron, yes.
...playing Captain Hook and Mr. Darling. But also, EastEnders fans, the actress playing Mandy, who was Nicholas Stapleton...
It was.
...as Peter Pan.
Yes.
Of course, the trend of a girl playing Peter Pan... Why is that so important to you, and why is that important as the piece in the whole, apart for obvious reasons?
There are Peter Pans that I've seen with boys playing Peter Pan. I don't think that works, because when I say boys, I mean 18, 19-year-olds. The whole idea of Pan is that he hasn't really approached puberty. Therefore, his voice hasn't broken. And if you have... a 19-year-old playing Pan who's had a training, then you've got to get over that whole idea of a Pan who actually looks as though he's almost grown up. And the whole point of the story is that this is a boy who cannot grow up or does not wish to grow up. So the closest you can get is to have a girl playing Pan who can play it genuinely in an androgynous way and really fool us and fool the children in the audience that they are watching a boy who is about 12 years old. And Nikki achieved that. She's a wonderful actress. She's got this fantastic husky naturally...
Edge of puberty.
Yes, yes. And she looked amazing. She's as fit as a fiddle, or was in those days. I'm sure she still is. She was fantastic with a sword in her hand. I mean, you know, the fight... She was a fight director's dream, because she really, really looked as if she had taken lessons from Errol Flynn, you know. And she looked like Peter Pan.
Because she started in the EastEnders when she was 16. How old was she when she did this show?
I don't know, to be honest. I think she must have been in her sort of early 20s. Mm. I think 22, 23-ish, maybe. That's a guess.
And did she bring anything that you never thought possible to the character?
What she did bring was heart. And it was natural. We really felt for Peter with Nikki. I don't know if that was your experience when you saw the show, but she got to the kids and the mums and dads every night by playing it for real. And actually, Ron did too. I mean, you know, he used to play Hook in a very comedic but very dangerous way, very dark, dangerous way. But Nikki's triumph as Pan was heart and emotion. And when she sang "Don't Say Goodbye" at the end of the show, which is quite a late addition to the score, actually, I wrote it for the West End production, and it's since, I'm being told, one of the highlights of the show. But it's sort of
lovely song.
It's great fun, that song. Yeah, but Nikki sang it with heart, and not a dry seat in the house, as they say.
Is there a difference between writing for families and writing for children? Not performers, but the audience. What do you think in this?
A brief answer, no. Long answer, easy to understand why no, and that is, write it for real. Don't write down to children. Write it for real. Make sure that the storyline, which you must move forward as in the quickest possible way, make sure your storyline moves ahead, that the kids in the audience can follow it, and then demand that they have the sort of attention span you want them to have. The moment you write down to them, and I'm probably now going to say something incredibly unpopular, I think a lot of pantos, and I know there are a lot of panto fans listening to your podcasts, a lot of pantos speak down to the children, in my opinion.
Hello, boys and girls.
Yes, it is. It is. It's, and there are aspects of Peter Pan which are pantomimical, like, as I say, like the Tinkerbell recovering scene where the fourth wall comes down, and there is communication between the audience. But
the dog as well is also great.
And the dog is, you're absolutely right, Nana. Yes, but the note I always give the actor playing Nana, and it's almost inevitably one of the pirates who has to don the dog skin because they've got nothing to do but sit in their dressing room in Act 1.
Give them work, go on.
So one of the pirates usually has to put on Nana's costume. But play the dog for real. Don't try and be clever. Don't try and play down, oh, we've got children in the audience, therefore we can do what you've just done. Hello, boys and girls. You know, it is about heart, moving the story along and making sure that the music is accessible. And by accessible, I mean that it's got melody that kids can latch onto quickly. So for me, not that I can write complicated music, I can't. I've tried, but I can't. For me, don't try and be too complicated.
That's always one of the best rules with composing, I find, is if you do try and overcomplicate something, it generally tends not to work. If you keep it...
Or you're right. Or it's appreciated hugely by musicians who go, my goodness, that was clever.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have dared done that.
13-8 bar for
yeah,
one.
That's very clever. And the non-musicians go, huh? Mm. Yeah, that's strange. When I say simple music, you don't have to stick to three chords. Your tonic, your subdominant,
always
and your dominant.
The colour of the music is the harmony.
Yes.
The sketch can be as simple as you want.
Your chord sequences can be actually quite complex. But it's the melody that needs, in my opinion, to be very approachable to all ears. And the other reason I said no to your original question was children are your biggest critics. your biggest critics.
Well, they'll yawn when they want to.
You know what? If they are bored, they will climb over the seats. They will want to go off to the toilet. They'll want the ice cream early. They'll start talking to their mums and dads. And if they're not bored, they're on the edge of their seats with their mouths open, watching. And one of my greatest notes that I give my actors when I'm directing anything is, if there are children in the audience, the only thing that you need to be asking yourselves is, what are they asking themselves? And what are the kids asking themselves? One question. What happens next? Yeah. That's all they're interested in. You know, forget how clever the costumes are. Forget how clever the scenery is and how it moves. And the approach to entertaining children is, what happens next?
That was a problem I noticed with Wind in the Willows at the Palladium, is that
I didn't see it.
A lot of the kids, and sadly some of the adults, were a bit bored come
right,
you know, 2 hours and 20 minutes into this production.
Really? Yes. Well, I didn't see it. It was suggested that I go and see it, but I've done a Toad myself.
Which I think I saw at Colwick Court when I was...
Did you?
Soon after this. And
right.
I have no way of proving that, I don't know, because I don't remember much about it. But to me, you are Mr. Adapting a British Musical for the mass market.
Sort of, yes. I suppose I've kept to one formula, which is to take existing classics. So all my shows to date are based on, if you like, unashamedly family, and unashamedly shows that I think the parents will feel very safe about taking the children to, but also the choice of titles is there because parents might feel that, well, actually, this is a classic, and I'm going to take our children to see this because Peter Pan is a classic. Through the Looking Glass is a classic. The Adventures of Mr. Toad is based on The Wind in the Willows. It's a classic.
With the best character.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I played Toad for years and years and years in my acting days. About 4 years I did him, I think. But that's another story. We'll come on to that in a minute. But you're right. I've always stuck to adapting English classics, if you like, for that reason. And it seems to have worked.
They also sell good worldwide as well, don't
they? They do. It's
also very important.
Well, it is. I mean, you know, you can write... You can be a very famous composer, and you can write a composition or a piece of musical theatre called The Gate. And it can be brilliant, but nobody's going to go and see it until a huge marketing hype is going to become behind the gate.
Hamilton, for example.
Well, exactly. You've got an uphill struggle. If you're writing for the whole market, so the professional market, the community theatre market, the Amdrams, and the touring, and the schools, and, you know, let's start with a story that... has a title that everyone recognises. I mean, Chris Blackwood, who I've done three shows with now, or maybe four, is it? He's a master craftsman in adaptation of classics, and his lyrics are way better than mine. And his structure is fantastic, which is, most recently, I've just done the music, and Chris has done the book and the lyrics. And we've got Through the Looking Glass, for example, which I originally did in at the Theatre Hall in Plymouth in 1984, I think. And Chris reworked my book and reworked that story. And I kept a fair amount, about half the score that I did in Plymouth, and then added to the score from Chris's new book and lyrics. It's about as far removed from Lewis Carroll as you can possibly get, but it's still got... I mean, it's still got the heart, and it's still got the characters. And Chris has made it into a real adventure story. But it's got that title, Through the Looking Glass, you know. And it's out of copyright, of course.
How is it having... I mean, musical theatre's great because you can... It's amazing how you have a piece, then someone else enters your life, and it changes into something completely different while still sustaining somehow the heart of what you did originally.
Yeah.
how is it, as someone who's done all three disciplines of musical theatre, the book, the music and the lyrics,
yeah,
how is it to suddenly work with someone else and who does two of those?
Fantastic. Oh, it's...
The lyrics are the hardest bits. You've got to do them eight times, haven't you?
You know what? When I started working with Chris, the wonderful thing was he stretched me immediately. He said, this is a such and such number. Mm-hmm. And I went, really? Are you sure? And he said, yeah. Listen to my lyrics. And he would read to me his lyrics without song, but he would read me the lyrics. And I would go, oh, that's what you've done with that line. Okay, that's what you've done. And what I was doing was being completely stretched as a composer in directions that he was taking me. And they would probably be directions that I would never have stretched myself. And he was saying, and sometimes I would write, I mean, most recently, Chris and I have just finished Tales of Hamelin. And it's quite dark, but funny as well. But we don't bring the kids back at the end. They actually go into the mountainside, and that's where they stay. So it's quite dark. Chris and I would start working on Hamelin, and we started that actually in concept stage while we were recording Around the World in 80 Days, which is another one that he and I did. He would send me lyrics on Hamelin, because he lives in a completely different part of the country. So we only meet about once or twice when we're writing musical. We do everything on the phone and by email and so on. And I would send him some musical ideas based on the lyrics he would send me. And it wasn't always that way around. Sometimes it was the other way around. I would do the music first and then he would do the lyrics. Very often he would go, no, that's, I didn't mean that at all. And I'd be back to the drawing board. And of course, if you write your own show, you don't go through that stage of no. You think what you've done is fantastic and you move on to the next number. But when you're working with somebody and they go, no, I didn't mean that at all.
Over the summer, I scored a fireworks show.
Yeah.
And it was just, in a way, being a composer is the loneliest job in the world, because yes, you're just, yeah, sat in a room. You've got no one to bounce ideas off.
True.
And it's so worrying, because the people that you are writing it for, you know, you put in this massive effort, you've done, yes, a full orchestral track and things, and what if they don't like it? You know?
Well,
do you think he's the boss now when it comes to your collaboration? Or is it?
Not necessarily. No, I'm sure, because I know Chris works with other composers. I think he's just done a treatment of Robin in the Seven Hoods with another composer. He does stretch me. Mm. And I happen to value the way he structures a book. I mean, I think his Around the World in 80... I mean, I read it now and I still roar out loud with laughter. I mean, I think his book is very funny and his characters are very funny. And his lyrics are very, very pertinent and amusing and clever, and it's a joy to write a song to a lyric that arrives, and if you can really bring that lyric out in the music, mm, which is, because people forget a song is about the lyrics as well as about the melody, and
the song
if
has to be sung, that's,
yes,
without lyrics are nothing,
and it's got to have that emotion behind it. And you can have the best melody in the world, and if the lyrics are rubbish, then the song doesn't work, and vice versa.
I always like lyrics first, because that drives what I need to do.
Yes.
Well, title first, lyrics, and then, yeah, music. I very, very rarely can do music first, unless I have an absolute idea of what the song needs, yes, to do.
That is true, and it is easier. However, with Chris, sometimes I would play him something that didn't have a lyric, or I would play him a song from a show which hadn't done anything, and I'd written it for another adaptation, and I would play him. That happened in Christmas Carol, actually, when we did. We've done a Christmas Carol, which is doing rather well, actually, worldwide. We're very happy with it. And I played him this song, which ended up to be the lovely sort of melody, the slow number. Sung by Scrooge's Belle, sung by Belle, Scrooge's girlfriend, when he was young. And I played that to Chris, and he said, keep that, I'm going to put a lyric to it. Because he loved the song. And we did that twice more, I think, in 80 Days. I think I had a couple of numbers. And I said, what do you think of this? And I would play him the number. He said, keep that, I want to put a lyric to that. So sometimes it does work the other way around.
But do you think that means you're breaking away from the musical world you've already created if you're going back to previous scores and taking songs that didn't work in one show and kind of plonking it in another?
Well, I think...
to be as polite as possible.
Absolutely. I think a tune is a tune is a tune. And if it's a tune that reaches people's hearts and it conveys an emotion which is right for that particular moment in the story, then that tune will almost work as well with that particular story as that tune will work with another story. And as I say, I think the other test of time is whether an actor can get up and sing one of the songs, for example, at an audition, and put the right amount of emotion in it. And if the song works absolutely out of context in that way, then that song will almost certainly work in context with all sorts of different titles.
Let's go back to Peter Pan and talk about Ron Moody, because Ron, massively famous for, of course, Fagin, and he did the show, then he did the film, of course.
Yes.
Tell me about him.
Ron was... it's like working with a legend. I remember first meeting Ron over lunch when we were he had been sent to meet us by his agent, and he said quite gruffly, "Oh well, are we going to do this or not?" And I said, "Well, I really hope we are, Ron, you know." And he said, "Well, do the deal, then I look forward to rehearsals, you know." And
very short lunch.
Yeah, it was. And then it was a challenge, but a total delight to work with him. He's a perfectionist. It is like being in the same room as somebody who is a legend, and I've admired him ever since I saw him play Fagin. This was not the first time he'd played Captain Hook. He reminded me he'd been in the West End before, much as a much younger man playing Hook. So he had some very concrete ideas which he wanted me to put back into the musical, which I was very happy to do. There's a soliloquy that happens on the pirate ship, which is now in my script. It's the traditional soliloquy from J.M. Barrie's original play. And it was very, very important to Ron that this soliloquy was in my adaptation, because he obviously enjoyed doing it previously when he played Hook before, and in it went, and we've kept it in because he did it so beautifully every night. He was very demanding in rehearsals. He wanted to get things right, quite rightly, and he wanted to do things over and over and over again until he was happy that they were right. So a perfectionist to that extent.
Did you write any songs for that show that he sang?
Yes and no. Rich Damp Cake, which is the big pirate number at the beginning of Act 2.
Always pantomime.
Which is a bit pantomime, but if you play it straight, it's funny. So Ron would play it absolutely straight, as if singing about a poisonous cake put on the shores of the Mermaid's Lagoon is the most natural thing in the world. Mm. And he would play that very, very straight. And that's why it was funny, because if Hook had thought he was singing about something funny, it wouldn't have been funny. So when we came to record Rich Damp Cake, Ron said, "What happens if I sing this, this, and this, and this, and then I sing over the top of the pirates?" And I said, "Well, I'd never thought of that. Let's try it." Mm. And so when we came to record Rich Damp Cake, the second time the chorus comes round, Ron is actually singing over the top of the pirates, and we kept it in. We kept it on the EMI, and we kept it in at the Cambridge as well.
So you recorded it before?
We did. We recorded it before rehearsals started, and we had very, very little time to record the whole album. So we were working through until about 4 o'clock every morning, and then getting about 3 or 4 hours sleep, and then going back to the studio again.
I guess you never thought Ron Moody would be singing these songs when you wrote them for a school.
No. No, not at all, and far, far less that I'd be directing him, you know. When Ron wanted to do the tour, but in the end we were going too far afield for him, because he was in his early 70s in those days, you know, and he only passed on, of course, about a year ago, was it? Yeah, in his 90s. And Terry Donovan took over. Terence Donovan, Jason's dad, took over Captain Hook because in those days Terry was very big in Neighbours, of course, playing a character whose name I can't remember. But Terry Donovan took over, and Rich Damp Cake went back to being the way it originally was, because I'm sure Terry were the first to admit he wasn't a great singer, but he was super in the part. He was great.
Because I seem to remember Act One ended at the end of Come Away, which is when they're flying.
No,
to Neverland.
No, a lot of people think it does. It ends when Peter and Wendy are on the rock, and Peter says the immortal lines, "To die will be an awfully big adventure," which of course is pure Barry, and Wendy looks up as the tide is rising, the dry ice is rising and rising, and she screams no, and as she screams the curtain comes down, and that's how we send the audience into their gin and tonics.
Ice creams, yes. Because it's a difficult structure, because you'd think nowadays you'd have Act One would be when they,
yeah,
you know, like the Charlie and Chocolate Factory, they arrive in the factory and yes, Act One.
Yeah.
But
it's too short.
Yeah, it's very short.
When I direct it, I always say to my company, the most difficult part of this show in terms of keeping the children glued to the stage is the opening. Once we get out of that nursery, once we're flying over London and we're in Neverland, it's so exciting. It's so exciting that the show takes care of itself. But when you've got all that dialogue between Peter and Wendy, it's got to zip, 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 zip. People have got to pick up their cues. It's all background, but it's essential background for Act Two to make any sense at all. So that dialogue between Peter and Wendy before they learn to fly, before John and Michael awaken from their beds, that's a very, very difficult part of the show. So it goes at a huge pace, which means they're flying within about 20 minutes of the curtain going up. And by the end of Come Away, it's 25 minutes, and you can't bring an interval in after 25 minutes. That's why.
I think it
originally was in four acts, and of course,
I was going to say it's a very wordy play, isn't it?
It was so long.
You looked at it obviously and thought, cut massive swathes of dialogue.
Yes, absolutely. I tried.
How
to keep
did it feel rewording a lot of it? Did you feel you were treading on?
No, I tried. I was always aware that keeping the Barry spirit of the piece was fundamental to the adaptation, and so why reinvent the wheel, basically? I mean, I've seen so many different Peter Pan adaptations, and they all go wrong, in my opinion, when people try and improve on Barry. However, you're right, Barry's original play from 1904 at the Duke of York's, which was the first ever performance, of course.
In front of children from the Great Ormond Street Hospital.
Yes, indeed. And the following year in New York. His original play, the curtain came in every time they changed the set, and people had cups of tea.
While
behind the...
I highly approve.
Behind the curtain, there was the scene change going on, then the curtain would go up again, and we would be from the nursery into Neverland, and then the curtain would come down, and the curtain would go up again, we'd be in the Mermaid's Lagoon, and then the curtain would go down, the curtain would go up again, we'd be in the pirate ship, and so on. Today, everything's got to move, boom, boom, boom. You know, you've got to move very, very fast, and the set changes have got to happen in a wonderfully magic way before the audience. So, Flight Over London is done with the nursery breaking up, literally, with the characters in midair. Yes, so it was chop, chop, chop from Barry's original script, but trying to keep the spirit of Barry alive.
And have you added anything to the show over the years since the West End production?
It's funny you say that. I don't think I'm going to change the score unless, because musicals are not set in stone. There's one theatre that actually called us, and I can't say who they are because they haven't made a decision yet, but there's one theatre, lovely, lovely theatre, who called my office the other day to say, is it available? Can we have the rights? I know they're looking at probably other Pans as well as mine, and probably other musicals as well for their next Christmas show. So I can't say who they are, But if they said to me, here we are in 2017, of course things have moved on. Of course musicals as a genre have moved on. And if they say to me, you know what, I really think the Pirates could do with another song at that point. Would you mind writing
one? Hip-hop song.
And I would probably say, yeah, that's what a good
would
idea.
Would you then work with, is it Chris?
It could be Chris or with Pan, because I know it backwards. Mm. I think I would probably just put another song in, you know. So I'm always adaptable if a theatre want me to. But the show that goes out from Samuel French, having said that, we're in our fourth edition now with French's. And I'm happy to say it's one of their top sellers, so they informed us the other day. And every time they finish an edition, I go, stop, because I might want to change a line here, change a line there.
About where did you know that And Straight On Till Morning was something Disney added?
Second to the Right and Straight On Till Morning.
I think the original is just Second Star to the Right.
The original from Barry is Second Star to the Right and Straight On Till Morning. That is the original. That's what's in the play. I changed it to Second to the Right because I couldn't fit Star into Come Away, Come Away. There was one too many beats in the bar. So Second to the Right, Second to the Right.
You don't want to be too clever and put that 5-4 bar in.
No. So Second to the Right, Second to the Right fitted very nicely. So Star was cut. And
cut the Star.
But Straight On Till Morning is a lovely finish because it lends itself to that huge harmonic finish, which is also the end of the aerial ballet that we do, Flight Over London, when the instrumentation takes over halfway through the song, and it goes into 3-4 for a while, while Nicholas Stapleton is turning somersaults and doing all sorts.
And I remember specifically my mum turning to me at the end of that song, said that was amazing.
Good fun, yeah. Good fun. In Holland, we had a super Peter Pan called Vera Mann, and she was a very, very well-known Dutch musical theatre star. And when I directed it over there and Vera was playing Peter, I think she spent more time on the wire because she wanted to look so natural and so accomplished. And she would turn somersault by the time it came to the performances. She'd spent I don't know how many hours practicing, and she was turning somersaults and doing sort of aerobatic this, that and the others. So Flight Over London became twice as long as it was at the Cambridge because everyone was saying, oh my God, this is over too fast and Vera is too wonderful, and the kids behind her were also, you know, where Wendy is joining hands with John and Michael, and they're also swaying amongst the stars. And the buckets of dry ice below them, and the clouds and the lighting and all that, and so we actually increased Flight Over London. So the Dutch recording is a much longer song than the English recording, and we had a lot of fun with the Dutch recording. And also, all the tempos on the Dutch recording are about 3 notches up. So because I just thought we need to make this more exciting, you know. I had a wonderful arranger called Derek Kaiser in Holland, and his speciality was arranging for theatre, but he also orchestrated for a lot of albums over there, a lot of rock albums. And Derek's forte was to take the original score and really update it. When you hear it, apart from it'll sound quite strange listening to it in Dutch, of course, but the orchestrations are very exciting. And that was released by Decca Columbia label. They gave us about 3 times more time in the studio than we had with the EMI version, so we were able to really go to town on recording it carefully.
Because I listened to the 90s recording, and it is very much a 90s recording, especially Don't Say Goodbye, which sounds, you know, nowadays it would be a pastiche of a 90s ballad. And I want to hear it with a symphony, you know, because it's such a lovely song.
Yeah, that's kind of you to say that. I was told the other day, I worked with an Arts Ed student just down the road, of course, Arts Ed, your Arts Ed just down the road from here. You know, I recently worked with a very talented Arts Ed boy who's in his final year, and he sang the Pied Piper on our new recording. Luke Hall, his name is. Hi, Luke, if you're listening. It's become the pullout number, and in the recording with EMI, we have a clarinet, which is the feature, and the first thing Derek did away with was the clarinet, and he put a raunchy saxophone into that, the beginning, and it's completely transformed the number into what you describe quite rightly as pastiche, 90s pastiche, into something which is really quite raunchy and lovely. And
what's great about it is, you were talking earlier, it is a song that can be taken out.
Yeah, they do it for auditions all the time, apparently. Yeah. It's quite a belt. It sounds that it goes higher than it really does. It only goes up to an E. And an E, for those non-musicians listening, a belt means when a singer is not using their tra-la-la-la-la head voice. A belt is when they're singing in the way a pop star sings, which is using their chest voice. Belting up to an E is actually entirely possible. When you start getting to an F, which is a semitone higher, or an F sharp, belts become pretty difficult, unless you're a very high tenor. Don't Say Goodbye only actually goes as far as an E, but that is still quite high, and if you want to show off in an audition, sing Don't Say Goodbye and then belt it brilliantly at the end,
but also
on your top E.
Quite impressive, considering she's worked so hard somersaulting and flying and doing all this stuff, and then she has to sing this massive song.
I'm glad you brought that up, that we do cheat. We do cheat, and now I'm going to give away a trade secret. When you've got a harness on and you're flying 10 feet above the stage, one of the things, in order to be very, very safe, to look after your backbone, your spine, as an artist, is that the harness needs to be very, very tight. And it also needs to be very tight around you if you've got the single wire. And when I direct Pan, we only ever had the single wire. I don't like the double wires, because it looks like Peter is on a trapeze rather than magically flying. And if you've got a very, very tight harness on, you can't breathe. Not to be able to fill your lungs properly to really belt a song out. So we do what we call click a little bit. So when Pan is over London, there is a moment when we switch from her singing live to something that's been pre-recorded, but the audience don't know, and it doesn't spoil their enjoyment. And I don't think, people often ask me, isn't that a cheat? Haven't I come here to see a live performance? And the answer is yes, you have. But do you want to hear a Peter making a very strange sound when she's flying, or he's flying over London, because she can't breathe properly because she's got a harness on, you know?
So does she sing Don't Say Goodbye with the harness on? I can't remember.
Only at the end. Only right at the end. The Don't Say Goodbye is actually between Peter and Wendy, before Peter makes that final exit through the French windows, which is what we call the pendulum flight. And that is a very dramatic flight. And in Holland, Vera, who played Peter, said, I'm going to do that one backwards. And at the time, I said to her, you're mad. Don't start flying backwards. You won't see where you're going. Because although it looks like an artist is in control when they're flying, they're not. They're completely at the mercy of the
foy
of the people who are yanking them on the wire. And Vera said, no. I'm going backwards. So her final exit every night in Holland, she stretches out her hand to Wendy. And of course, this is radio, so nobody can see what I'm doing except you, Nick. But she stretches out her
hand. Is now flying across the room, out the window, backwards.
She stretches out her hand to Wendy, and the final Don't Say Goodbye is when she does that massive pendulum flight. But in Holland, she did it backwards, which was very dramatic, because
it
was quick, and she never took her eyes off Wendy for a second until she disappeared into the ether. Backstage, and Wendy goes charging towards the French windows, waving, of course, and the curtain comes down. But yes, occasionally we cheat, and we do. I think that final Don't Say Goodbye also is clicked, as we say in the trade.
Yeah. Ruin my childhood, please. Where can people go to find out more information about all your shows that you have to offer?
We have a website now, which is looked after by my marketing manager, Richard Thomas. Richard has been with me for many, many years now, and he's responsible for liaising with my publishers in Australia, South Africa, MTI in New York, Samuel French, of course, over here, MTI now in Europe. They used to be called Joseph Weinberger. And they're now MTI.
Did Cameron buy them, or was that another company?
Well, Cameron, I'm not sure. I think Cameron owns over 50% of MTI New York, which means he must own MTI Europe as well, or over 50% of MTI Europe. And they publish a lot of musicals, of course, and they look after my Adventures of Mr. Toad, the Wind in the Willows adaptation we were talking about earlier. So Richard, in my office, liaises with all those people. He's largely responsible for licensing all our professional productions, as well as the amateur productions of Through the Looking Glass, not Mr. Toad, that's MTI, Christmas Carol, Around the World in 80 Days, the new one, which has just been released, Tales of Hamelin, which is being very well received, I'm happy to say. So where can people find out about my musicals? itmshows.com, and it's all there, and the whole score of all the shows is on that website. So if people want to hear any of the songs from any of the shows, they've all been professionally recorded with orchestras as opposed to Casio machines, if you know what I mean. Nothing, not that there's anything wrong with Casio machines, Mr. Casio, sorry. So all the songs can be heard on that website. And, of course, if people want CDs that they can play, they can order the CDs from that website as well.
They're on iTunes and Apple Music.
They're on iTunes
and Spotify and all this.
And all of that.
All the modern streaming services.
Modern streaming services. People like to own their own CDs, so yeah. we often send out CDs as well. And I will send you the Dutch recording and any other recordings you
want. When I was at university, I actually wrote to the office and wrote a cheque for the CD of Peter Pan, because I'd lost the one I got for my birthday.
Oh, I hope we sent it to you, didn't we?
We did.
Oh, good.
I've got it up on my shelf.
Oh, good. Along with about 104,000 other musicals. My goodness, that's a lot of CDs.
Yeah. Piers, thank you very much for coming on to Musical Talk. It's been an absolute pleasure. And
pleasure's been mine.
Yes, thank you very much.
It's been lovely to meet you.
This episode of Musical Talk, presented and edited by Nick Hudson, copyright 2017. Apart from the songs, where the copyright persists with the original creators.